Welcome to the Healing Trauma and CPTSD podcast. I'm your host, Monique Coven. I'm a certified trauma, recovery, and resilience coach, and this podcast is all about hope and recovery. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today, I'm going to share with you a conversation I had with my good friend and colleague, Kimberly Weeks. Kimberly is also a trauma recovery coach, and we are having a conversation about really racial trauma recovery. There is so much in this conversation that was insightful, and I just learned so much. It really opened up my eyes, and I'm happy to share it with all of you. Hi, Kim.
Hey, Monique. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Wonderful. Excellent. I'm so glad we're going to be able to have this conversation today because I think it's a very pertinent one for what's happening right now.
Totally. I'm so excited because Kim is a trauma recovery coach, narcissistic abuse coach, and just talking about what's going on in the world right now. You and I were talking a bit about this privately, and I thought the way that you were explaining it to me, I said, oh, we got to record on this, about how it's, the world is responding to what's happening in like a traumatic response. So can you share with us a little bit about how you see that happening, or how is that happening?
Well, the purposes of this discussion, this is just like what we do with our clients every day with trauma recovery. Okay. And there's five parts of trauma recovery. The cycle that occurs when a person experiences trauma or an event that changes the way that they see themselves, the way they see others, or the way they see the world around them. That is a traumatic event or experience. And so there is a process that we have to, or a natural flow of a process that we go through in order to recover fully from trauma. And I think that as a global community, we are experiencing both with this pandemic, you know, people keep talking about the Spanish flu of 1912. I mean, you know, there's just all these different things that are happening right now. I think it was 1920, actually. So there's some different components that happen with recovering from trauma. The first response, or the first thing that happens in trauma recovery, is people go into denial. And then the next stage is chaos. Mm-hmm. The third stage for trauma recovery is the actual part where you begin the recovery process. So recovery is the third stage. And then the fourth stage is where you are reclaiming your life, reclamation. And then finally, that final stage is when you are an advocate or advocacy. And so most people who experience a traumatic event, my specific niche is narcissistic abuse survivors, will go through this cycle where they are going through denial and chaos to recovery, to reclaiming their lives, and then on to advocacy. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, we've learned with trauma recovery that typically people stay in either denial, or they move from denial into chaos, and they never actually shift into recovery. They never acknowledge what has happened to them and do some personal work with professionals, mental health professionals, whether therapists, coaches, et cetera, psychiatrists, et cetera, to begin, you know, doing the healing work that's necessary to shift through this recovery process. And I see the world in that same process right now. So, I mean, I don't know, is any of this resonating for you, Monique?
Yeah. So I'm wondering, when you say denial,
mm-hmm.
I would say that we have been in denial
mm-hmm.
so long. And how do you see right now? Do you see, as we are in like a sort of chaos where we are not in denial anymore. I mean, we see, oh my gosh, we have been in denial. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure there's people that are still in denial.
Correct.
But that, you know, if we were to look at that in terms of the stages, would you say that this is kind of chaos? People are not knowing what to do. They want to do, they want to help. There's all this energy.
Yes, that's exactly where we are. We're in chaos in the recovery process. As it relates to racial trauma. And, you know, you're in Canada, I am in the United States, and our country has a specific history around, you know, slavery and, you know, African-Americans and different immigrants, because obviously we're a country of immigrants, and how those immigrants were classified in the country and put into different categories of worthiness and value based on their skin color or what country they came from. And that's continuing to happen for our Latin American countries with America. But yeah, that's where we are. We're in chaos because people are no longer numb to the reality now that we can see it on television and it's being recorded and we have audio. There is an unnumbing, a coming out of the ether, so to speak, for people to have the awareness that this is really a thing. It may not be impacting me. It may not affect anyone I personally know, but I see this and it's shocking. Whereas for me, as an African-American woman, I have grown up with parents that went through Jim Crow. Grandparents that went through Jim Crow, parents that went through the civil rights movement. And so this has been a common discussion, common reality, you know, thing that we've been having. And I've had conversations with my children about what it means to be Black in America. And so, you know, I'm not shocked. It's normal for me. Normal. It's like normalized dysfunction, if that makes sense, or normalized experience. And so the people that are becoming unnumb right now, it does push you into chaos. It does incite anger and a range of emotions, just like any other trauma. I don't know if that's what you guys are experiencing in Canada, but that's what we're experiencing here.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of the same here. And so I'm thinking about, again, that list, and what I'm seeing, Kim, is a lot of people in the chaos jumping to, we got to do this. We got to do that. Tell us what to do. Advocate, do this, do that. And so I even found myself kind of getting caught up in that adrenaline. I got to do something.
Right.
But feel that there's a couple of stages that feel like they've missed something.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is one of the cool things about being trauma informed, because there is a process to this. And a part of that process is moving and shifting from either denial into chaos or chaos into recovery, where you have to actually sit with, this is what we do with our clients every day. We have to sit with the reality of what we're experiencing it. We have to become fully aware and this is a real issue, problem, injustice. And this is what our world is now. And because trauma makes you feel unsafe in the world, or to experience the reality that there is unsafety for specific people, you know, it's kind of the same thing as, you know, for our country, kids that are locked in cages and separated from their parents, or, you know, people who are dealing with sex trafficking, or when you realize that that's happening out there, you have to shift into, okay, I'm going to not deny this. I am going to, you know, not feel that sense of being out of my window of tolerance, or the window of my capacity to be able to, my system to be able to handle what's happening. And I go into, it's like we see a little toddler who has a tantrum. I go into almost like a tantrum because I can't stomach, I can't handle what's happening right now, and go, yep, this is what we're dealing with. We know this from our trauma recovery training. You know, we get out of our amygdala, get out of our survival brain. And a part of that is grieving. I think that's what we're seeing globally. There is a global grief. happening.
Oh yeah. You know, I don't know what I saw. Something I saw where there was, I think someone posted it on Facebook. There was like a group of people that were on their knees and they were repenting for what they have done. And these African Americans were standing up and some of them were crying, some were wailing. And I, just by watching that, there was this part of me, but I held it back. I could feel like I wanted to join in the wailing.
Yes.
My body was like feeling so much. And I think that is really recognizing that there is repentance and a real, you know, sorrowfulness. It's not enough to understand with our cognitive brain.
Right.
Got to really in the body to, to feel it. And
right. Let it move into the body and experience what's coming up for you, which is very difficult for people to do. And we've, you know, we've talked about this many times, for you to sit with yourself and feel the feelings. And that shock place that many people, or that denial place that many people have been in, is safer in terms of what you experience in your body. It's safer to act like it's not happening.
Yeah.
You know, we talk, we deal with this with clients all the time. And when you become unnumb, it does feel out of control.
Yes.
It does feel chaotic.
Yeah.
But until we allow for that process, until we allow for that chaos, which is, I think, what these, you know, what you're seeing with people being willing to go take it to the streets. It's a global, national, in every country, expression of grief.
Grief. Yeah. And that's the part that is, I really cannot be skipped. You can't just jump from, you know, understanding with your mind and jumping to advocacy.
Exactly.
You've got to feel that internal, hey, this was so, so, so wrong. It's not right. And the remorse over that.
And people are trying to shift from denial to advocacy. And it's not the depth of what has to transform in our inner person and our inner man. It cannot happen that way. We can, when we come out of denial and it does feel chaotic, the advocacy is really an attempt to regulate your nervous system. It's an attempt to put out that fire.
That's exactly right.
Well, if I do this, then this means I'll be a good person and I'll be on the right side of this. And that's, there's nothing wrong with that sentiment. For people whose hearts are pricked and they're feeling compassion, there's nothing wrong with that. But it's still skipping steps.
Yeah, that totally. Yeah, it's that I feel sick. I feel horrible. I feel I got to do something.
I got to do something to get this feeling to go away. And I think that, you know, there have been some, I guess you could call it racial trauma responses that have come out of that feeling of chaos happening within people and wanting to put it out, wanting to not enter the recovery process of feeling the feelings and allowing our body to express it and the discomfort and the yuckiness. And all of those things, there's been some classic trauma responses that have really come out of it. And it really looks a lot like gaslighting. I don't know. You know, we know I've talked about gaslighting as it relates to narcissistic abuse, but it's showing itself.
So why don't you tell us a bit about that? Like, how do you see that?
So for instance, if a person comes across or is in conversation with someone who's experienced some type of racial violation, injustice, abuse, there are some typical responses that keep coming up as almost a way of deflecting or what's the right word, Lord? Defending, staying in the place of denial, or shifting back in the recovery process to denial. And some of those things sound like statements like, well, if the person peacefully or or protest it or set it in a way that was respectful, then maybe they would be listened to.
Mm-hmm.
It may sound something like, well, what I said or what I did, that's not racist. So it's a total gaslight because it's denying the reality that's being presented to you. It may sound like someone saying, oh, I was just joking. You know, you just need to calm down. It's not that serious. You know, you're just being real serious about this. And, you know, you're the one that's actually racist because of that. They'll turn the tables on that conversation. Mm-hmm. Or say something like, are you sure? Are you sure that that's what really happened?
My goodness.
You know, maybe it wasn't because of race. Maybe it was because the person didn't follow the direction, or maybe it was because they were there at the wrong time of day. Or when Trayvon Martin was killed, maybe it's because he wore a hoodie, or maybe it was, you get all of these kind of like deflections, for lack of a better term, for why something that is being presented to you and was unjust or was violence or was abuse, why it's not actually trauma. It's more like trying to isolate an individual situation, right, so you don't have to look at the systemic nature of it. And I think that is just in the trauma recovery process. That's just a person who is either in denial or feeling the edges or the boundaries of chaos and wanting to retreat back into some safety for themselves.
Yeah.
So those are examples of racial forms of gaslighting. And we, you know, I personally have heard these things, and when it's said, it's not said from a, it's either said from a place of, oh, you poor thing. And it's kind of like mockery. It's almost like, you know, someone patronizing me. Mm. Oh, so you really think that, you poor thing, that type of, or it's very aggressive. The person has shifted into a sympathetic space in their nervous system, and they're ready to fight or flight. All of this is about how a person is responding, yeah, to a trauma. Mm-hmm. You know, you can lay race on top of it. You can lay sexual abuse on top of it. You can lay family system of, you know, abuses or violations on top of it. It's all trauma response. It's all the trauma recovery cycle. And so people are really responding out of a desire to try to retreat into safety or to find safety with a topic they're uncomfortable or unfamiliar with.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And so, unfortunately, what that ends up tapping into, and I've had several people over the last few days who've reached out to me, make statements like, well, that was a long time ago. That was, you know, ancestors before ancestor. That's not who I am. And I find that it pulls up a sense of shame for many white and Caucasian people, or people that come from quote unquote white nations, is pulling at that shame of, well, if I acknowledge this, then somehow it's my fault. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like with a person who's been sexually abused. Well, you shouldn't have worn those clothes, and that's why the person raped you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, does that sound like it rings true in any way for your experience as being someone who is, you know, not an African-American person, and you hear these types of things? How does that impact you, Monique?
Yeah, I'm just wondering about like the shame, you know. Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, it sounds like shame to me anyway, that that's what it's touching.
Sure.
Or feeling responsible. I don't know.
Or feeling like, yeah, because the discussion is even being had, that person is personally saying that you've done something or you're responsible for it because, mm-hmm, you know, aren't doing X, Y, or Z. And we can get into that whole conversation now about, you know, what it means to process the unnumbing of coming out of chaos for all people, not just African American people, but everyone is in this trauma recovery process. Mm-hmm. And so it can feel almost like because you're white, that means that somehow I'm culpable or someone saying that I'm culpable or my family's culpable. And I don't want to accept or sit with or face that feeling. So I stay silent. So I avoid the conversation. Mm. So I shy away from those types of discussions. That's what I'm seeing happen quite a bit in an attempt to both regulate the nervous system or restore some sense of safety, but also to not invite other trauma and not say something that might be perceived in a wrong way. Mm-hmm. You know, or not feeling comfortable with how to say it or feeling like you're competent to, you know, have the conversation. So I'm just going to avoid it.
Yeah, that's one thing that I know a lot of people, I mean, are feeling. I was feeling that myself. And mm-hmm. I've heard different people say that. They're afraid of asking the wrong mm-hmm. questions. So either you're right, they'll just say nothing. Or,
right.
Yeah, they don't want to offend or say something wrong or stupid.
Right. And so when that happens, talking about the recovery process, how is it even possible for, you know, for any of us to move through recovering? And, you know, whether it's African Americans who've been experiencing this forever in a day or people who are just waking up to the reality of this, mm-hmm. how is it even possible if we're not able to be vulnerable with each other to say, you know what, when I was growing up, I heard the N-word in my house. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, I heard, you know, anti-Semitic, you know, slurs. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. It's just the way that people talked in my house. If you can't have those conversations and also admit, I don't know how to have this conversation.
Yeah. Right.
Then there's really, you can't shift into recovery. Recovery is about, and that's one of the things I love about trauma-informed care. Recovery is about not having to do it perfectly and just coming just as you are with an open mind and an open heart and wanting to acknowledge that this is something that I don't like is happening in me. And I want to do something to make some different choices. Mm-hmm. So acknowledging it and awareness and accepting that that's the reality, whether it's your mother was right. And then some of this is like, I don't want to deal with my family system.
Yeah.
I got a racist parent. Mm-hmm. I got a parent to this day that I can't, you know, be around, bring certain friends around.
Yeah.
And not wanting to face that again, that shame coming up to the surface.
Yeah. One of the good things, I think I told you, I had a conversation with my daughters. Mm-hmm. And I think that they were telling me a story about, this was many years ago, mm-hmm. about they were getting together some friends, and one of the boys' father had mm-hmm. him off to this group of people. And one of the boys was an African American, and the father said to this young fellow, "You mean you drove here?
Right.
You didn't take a bus?
Right."
And my daughter was burning inside. She mm-hmm. was like, "How, you're not asking anybody else that? Mm-hmm. How dare you ask that to him?" But she didn't say anything. And I said, you know, would you have said something today? And she's like, absolutely. But that's right. What I mean. I think now people are maybe feeling like, you know, maybe I wouldn't have said something then, but now I feel like I can speak up more.
Wow. And so what you're really speaking to is this concept of implicit bias. It's this bias that we have that governs our decision-making governs how we see people. That isn't like, it's almost in the subconscious parts of our brain. We're not even aware. It's not even in our full awareness that this is why we're operating like this. And we talked about this the other day because my son, my oldest son, I have four sons. My oldest son went to a neighborhood with one of his friends, and it was a very, you know, really nice, big, you know, homes, very expensive homes neighborhood. He was going there for a purpose that had something to do with his university. And my father, who is an African-American judge, asked him where he was going. And his response was, I'm going to such and such's house. And he said, well, what kind of neighborhood is it? That's the first question my dad asked. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, it's, you know, really kind of, it's a rich neighborhood. And he said, you can't go over there by yourself. That's the first thing he said to him. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing, my son just vehemently, oh, those are my friends. And, you know, I've been in school with them forever. And my dad said, I'm telling, he just looked at me, he said, please, I'm telling you, you're an African-American male. And if you go over in that neighborhood, someone's going to call the police on you.
Oh my goodness.
And he said, this is what I want you to do. He said, you're going over for a project or something. I want you to, he said, literally call the police department for that city and tell them this is where you're going and this is why you're going. And he just thought it was the most ridiculous thing. And, oh, that's not the way things are anymore. And blah, blah, blah. And he said, would you just trust me? And so my son called that police department, let them know why he was going over there. And it was for something, for college, for school. And he left the house. 15 minutes later, he called us. Because he pulled into the neighborhood, he went, you know, down this particular, you know, street into a cul-de-sac. And within 5 minutes, a police officer pulled up behind him. And the police officer had already been called. So the people that called, the police officer went to their home to assure them of what was going on, came back and said really kind, nice words to my son. And, you know, he went on about his business with going to his friend's house. But that's that happened like late last year.
I'm like, my mouth is wide open. Call the police department to let them know that you're going over?
Call the police department because people, quote unquote, will not believe that you're supposed to be there.
It's the same thing with the bus. You mean you're...
Correct.
You're not taking the bus? Oh my goodness.
So there's this assumptive... Mm-hmm. You know, racism. I'm assuming because you look like this, that means that these things fit you. You got to be from, you know, a home that you don't have your own vehicle because you look like this. Mm-hmm. You got to be in the wrong neighborhood. You know, you can't, you know, you're not supposed to be here because you look like this. I mean, that's real everyday occurrence for many African Americans in this country. Mm-hmm. So I say all of that to say that we have to start having that conversation with each other because there is a reality that there are some things that epigenetically have been passed down to us in our nervous systems that cause certain responses in our you know, our survival brain.
Yes.
Whether we were directly taught them, whether we were, you know, around people who said certain things and it formed the way that we saw the world, or, you know, whatever the situation may be. And we just have to be honest about it so that we can move out of shame, out of chaos, into recovery, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Wow. And so so after the chaos comes recovery.
And after the chaos comes recovery. That's right.
And that's before reclaiming.
Before you can reclaim and say, you know what, this is 2020. This is the way that I want to live my life. I'm going to choose, you know, to deal with what's happening on the inside of me and get whatever support, resources, therapy, coaching to process the things that have been traumatic for me so that I can move into reclaiming my life. And then start making conscious, intentional decisions about the life that I want to live. And a good example of that, you know, I live in my community in a predominantly white area, in Georgia, and there's a lot of young families in my community. There's a lot of people who are original owners and in their 80s, 70s, and 90s in my community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when all of this started to happen in the world, I really did not feel safe in my area. It's almost like a heightened or a maximizing of whatever feelings of not safety I was having with my children going out in their community, riding their bikes, going to their friend's house. And so I really had, you know, God really impressed it upon my heart that I don't have to choose to live that way. I've been doing trauma recovery work, you know, with the Lord and with my, you know, support team of folks. I've got a spiritual director. I've got a psychologist. I've got a psychiatrist. I've got coaches that I could talk to. I've got therapists. I've been doing this a long time. And so I've moved into that space of reclamation and advocacy. And so I just became aware, okay, this is what I'm feeling in my body. And I can choose to think and act differently. And so I sent out something to my community a few days ago and said, hey, I want, you know, us to do some kind of peace walk. I want my children to see that this is their home. This is their community. These are their neighbors and that they're safe. And, you know, 48 hours later, we showed up to do a peace walk in my community. And I was so surprised, woefully surprised at how many people showed up in support of that concept.
So how did you feel inside?
I felt loved, seen, heard, that my children matter, that my safety matters in my community, and that people were affirming that. That's exactly what it felt like. And that just like me, they're going through the same trauma in a different way, if they are of a different ethnicity or if they're white or in the majority, but that they're experiencing the same sense of grief. They're experiencing the same sense of, you know, I don't know what to do with this. And this gave them something to do, to come together in solidarity, to say, this is our community and we want it to be safe for everyone. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. Wow. So,
Kim, you did that? You started this?
I did.
Oh, I'm so proud of you.
Thank you. And I tell you that, you know, it's happening everywhere. It's happening everywhere.
Yeah.
Where people are saying enough is enough. I don't want to just be programmed to continue to have a fear survival response to things outside of my control. I can't control everything, but I can choose how I'm going to operate in my sphere of influence with the people I come into contact with and have relationship with. And that's, you know, then you can start advocating for folks. That's trauma recovery.
Yeah. Well, that was just such a beautiful example. Because you and your family were feeling vulnerable, mm-hmm. and you got together and you did this, and that was great. What a great experience for your kids too.
They'll remember it forever. I mean, literally, they will remember it for the rest of their lives. Uh-huh. Yeah. So I'm grateful to God for him putting that in my heart, writing it on my heart. Mm-hmm. But I think it begs another question because to me, what they did was hold space with us. That's mm-hmm. what that walk was. That's what the willingness to hear and listen was. Even with this pandemic and having the 6 feet of distance and people with masks, they said, we're going to hold space with you with what you're experiencing right now. And I think you can share a little bit more with me about it. But I think it's hard right now because people are having a trauma response personally within themselves, for them to be able to sit with the pain of someone else and stay regulated.
Yeah.
Is that what you feel?
You mean because of the pandemic?
No, I think because of the trauma of watching someone die on television causes their own personal inner experience of trauma, and they are dysregulated. So it's really hard to sit with somebody else's stuff if you've got your stuff going on.
Yes, 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 yes. No, I found that, you know what? And I'll be honest with you. I'm going to be honest. I felt when I saw that, you know, especially coming from a family where I was a witness too, as well, mm-hmm. to very bad violence. And so to watch that, I felt myself getting really deeply triggered.
Yeah.
How could I do that to a human being,
yeah.
and et cetera.
Yeah.
And then I could feel the old stuff coming up. But then I didn't want the old stuff to come up because this wasn't about me. So I felt guilty. So I pushed it away.
Oh,
and I said, okay, and I think that too is that some people might have gotten triggered themselves, but felt some guilt maybe that, no, this isn't about you right now, you know?
Yes, I do. And I've actually had several friends say that. I don't want to make this about me, but how we have this experience working with clients. A client may bring something to us. It's their stuff. We're there to serve them. But God at the same time is bringing something up for us at the same time to help process and heal for us too. That's the beautiful thing about coaching. And so whatever gets pulled up to the surface, it's an opportunity for you to address some things that are happening or have happened to you. And we can hold that space together. You know what I mean? And it's not that you make it about you, but don't deny don't go into your own cycle of denial and chaos.
Yeah, no, normally I wouldn't, but I'm saying with what was happening, we had just witnessed visually that murder and still, him saying, I want my mama. Anyway.
I know. I think that phrase, of course, called out to every woman every mama that ever was, it called out, you know? So I love that you shared that because, I think it is important. I will say it. I do think it is important not to, in conversations that you're having where you're trying to build a bridge and have understanding, I think it is important to remain. My mama used to say, make the main thing the main thing. to keep the topic at, of dealing with the experience of Black people and minorities and Native Americans and Hispanics and Latin American, whatever conversation you're in, make the main thing the main thing and stay on, on that topic. But still at the same time, not dismiss what God is really bringing up for you.
Yeah,
it can be privately. I mean, it can be with
privately. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's the same thing. You get triggered when you're watching a movie,
or when we're with clients. Something triggers us. We have to set that aside, and then come back to it when it's appropriate. But I think that's important to note because I think that many African Americans have had the experience of the topic of conversation being shifted, and it feels. Yeah. It feels, just like anyone else, it feels like all of a sudden you're not fully heard and seen and you're dismissed in some way. So I think it's important to note that. I really do. But the other thing that has come up recently is this whole concept of colorblindness. And I don't know if you've heard anything about this, but people will say, well, I don't see color.
Yes.
And I don't teach my kids to see color. That's not a part of our household. And they say it from the place, the well-intended place of, I want to relate to people as human beings. Absolutely beautiful sentiment. Okay. But I used to go to this church and it was called Tapestry. And I love that name. And when I think about colorblindness, I think about what if you had this tapestry that had rich hues of purple and rouge and burnt orange and, golden yellows. And what if you were colorblind and you couldn't appreciate it? What if you couldn't see all the different strands? What if you couldn't gaze upon that beauty, for lack of a better term? When someone says, I don't see color, in this country, experientially, and I don't know if this is how it is in Canada, it means you don't see me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It means my experience isn't worth acknowledging. It means that the cries that I have, the pains that I have, are not welcome. And so I know that the intention is well. I know that the heart of it is well, because we do have to meet in our humanity. But I am teaching, and I'm having, you know, these conversations with my kids from what they've, you know, heard growing up about quote unquote white people and the safety that there is or is not with white people. I want my kids to appreciate differences. I want them to appreciate different experiences. I want them to be able to say, you know, I have a white friend and, you know, this is what I got to experience in their household. And these are the cool things I took away from being a part of being around their family. And I want that same thing for them. Mm-hmm. I want us to be seen. So if you teach your children, if you teach your children not to see color, then they won't see it and value it. But if you teach them to see it, teach them to see it and appreciate it.
Okay, so that's the big main point.
Yes.
Because I think, like you said, well-intentioned, you know, everybody's equal. We see everybody right. The same, but I what you're saying, and yes, the appreciation of each, you know, ethnic diversity. And so how do you show it in an appreciative, good way? It's a big question, but, you know, how would you then teach your children? That's a huge question.
It's a huge question, but again, I'm going back to what I said before about, and particularly in my country, the history books have been taught to everybody the same way. So if there isn't an appreciation for the contributions of Black people in this country, or Japanese people in this country, or Native Americans, and if the narrative has been limited, then it is up to each of us individually to educate ourselves and then pass that on to our children. And then create some spaces for them to have relationships with people that don't look like or think like them.
Yeah.
Of course, in safety, you know, with people that you know, with safe people. And that's true of any situation. You open your life up to safe people. But that is what's going to create the spaces for, you know, what we've been quote unquote taught about certain, you know, cultural backgrounds to be challenged, to be questioned, to be examined, to be curious about, to learn from, all of those things.
Mm-hmm. So good. So before we end, is there anything else, Kim, you want to add to this conversation? Or
I think that if we approach this topic, the topic of racial trauma, okay, no matter what background you're from, whether you're white, whether you're Black, oh, we didn't even get on that discussion about what do you call it? what are we supposed to say to each other? Is it okay to say Black? Is it okay to say African American? Is it okay? You know, if I'm, you know, engaging with someone who's Asian, should I ask, you know, is your family from Vietnam? Are they from Korea? Are they from Japan? Are they from China? Should I ask those questions so that I'm being, you know, appropriately respectful and calling you according to what makes you feel comfortable? I've got a girlfriend who's Polish. She doesn't want to be called a Polak, quote unquote, because that is a term that's been used in a derogatory way, like the N-word. Can you use the N-word? Can you use it because it's in certain songs? Is it cool if you're singing a song? Is it never cool? Those are all conversations that have to be had. But personally, you have to take a stance on what you desire to do with that. And that's to each his own. You know, I personally do not use the N-word. Did I grow up hearing it? Yeah. But I'm telling all my business here, but so I didn't want to repeat that for my children. And around the time that I started having this thought in my mind, like, okay, so how do I not repeat that for them? The movie Finding Nemo came out. And I love that movie. It's one of my favorite movies. And so anytime I would grow up and hear the word Negro, okay, or the other one, I just replaced it with Nemo.
Nemo.
So I literally just started, like, it's almost like reprogramming my brain and how I thought about, okay, well, if someone says the N-word, then for us it's going to be Nemo. That's how we're going to say. And I tell you, there are so many friends of ours, my family, that's what they say now. My mom and dad now say it. Think about that. Okay. So where my mom and dad used to say Negro or the other word, now my mom and dad say Nemo. And so when I think about that, it doesn't feel like a negative connotation. It doesn't feel, you know, how like some people will say the B word is some kind of a, you know, term of endearment. You know, it doesn't have any kind of negative connotation for me at all. And I literally, from one generation to the next, we've changed that in our family system. It's those types of things that we have to be willing to have some conversations about. And so from a parting thought, I would literally say, you know, for folks to really sit with where they are, be honest about where they are with this topic of racial trauma, with this reality that we're now stepping into, in that recovery process. Really be honest. If you're in denial, you're in denial, no shade. If you're in chaos and your system is activated and you feel like you got a fight or flight, or you feel like you got a freeze and you don't know what to say or how to say it and you go silent, just be where you are. Become aware of that. Accept it with no shame. And then your brain can be restored out of survival brain for you to actually make some, you know, conscious, rational choices about how you move forward through the recovery process. That's really what where we are right now. And be willing to have those conversations without, you know, feeling the need to be anywhere but where you are. We've talked about that many times. That is the heart of trauma recovery.
So Kim, if people want to get in touch with you or find out about your work, tell us how
they can reach out to me on my website, which is thenarcissisticabusecoach.com. I am also on that same handle, The Narcissistic Abuse Coach, on Facebook and Instagram. And my assignment, the people I'm sent to and called to, are women who have experienced psychological, narcissistic, or sexual abuse, and or they've experienced childhood trauma that has created codependency. So those are the people that I'm called to serve. And it is the joy of my heart to do that work every day.
And you are just amazing at what you do. I've been on some of your webinars and they're just so informative and amazing. And you talk from the heart and from experience. So
absolutely.
That's great. All right, Kim. So
absolutely.
Thanks again. And
all right, you too. Thank you, Monique. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Okay.
If you would like to find out more information with regards to my coaching options, you could reach me on my website at www.cbtsdcoach.com. You can visit me on my Facebook and Instagram page at cbtsdcoach.